Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Bill Strelo is speaking on Jesus, men, and understanding. So let's listen in on Bill.
My name is Bill Strelo, and there are around five or so of us gathered here this afternoon to talk with one another around the subject of Jesus, men, and understanding. And I'd like us to... My name is Bill Strelo. I'm facilitator, not leader, facilitator here. And I want us to look at these words, Jesus, men, and understanding, in two ways. Jesus, comma, men, and understanding. And then, in quotes, Jesus, men, and understanding, as a way of looking at these as two different and distinct ways of knowing. Because that's what we're going to be talking with each other about this morning. Jesus, men in understanding, or subscript asterisks, the way we as men think is killing us. The way we as men think about ourselves and the way we think about one another and our responsibilities in the world has a tendency to kill us. And as I've said so many times during this week, if we look at our world, the world in which we inhabit, the people that mar the world the most in their attempt to make a mark on the world happen to be males. And I think men need to, without exception in terms of country or class or race or what have you, begin to think together on why this might be so. When we go out here to the reading room and we pick up the Seattle Post Intelligencer or pick up the New York Times, why is that males have such an aggressive tendency that it ends up killing one another? I've suggested that we have our conversation this week around what I consider four basic energies that men have. Women have them too, but my conversation has been around the four basic energies or givens or archetypes, if you're dealing with psychology, that are embedded deep within the masculine soul, the masculine psyche. The first of these we talked about was the energy of knowing and ordering, of authoring, how we author the world and how we author our lives. The second one was the energy of aggression, how we relate to the outside world, how we make an impact, how we get things done. That's an energy that some way, shape, or form we as men learn to regulate. We learn to regulate it well, or we learn to regulate it not so well. The third energy that we'll be talking about this afternoon is the energy of understanding how we use our smarts. That's a basic energy to human life, to human existence. And the fourth one is the energy of intimacy, how we relate to those outside of ourselves in a purposeful way, in a non-abusive way. What I want us to talk with each other this afternoon about is this energy of understanding or of using our smarts. And to see that in the function of elders and mentors. As an energy, the energy of eldership, the energy of mentoring, and as our responsibility as elders and mentors to boys and to other children, but specifically if we can say today for boys, as guides for the process of transformation of men from immaturity to maturity, as guides of that process both within ourselves and as we relate to the world. As I look at some of the material that's being uncovered now in terms of men's studies, one of the clear and cut and the decisive roles in a responsible society has been elders and mentors. In the past, they have been the linchpin of any society. And I dare say many of us can look to men that we might have had who have been elders to us and or mentors, who have helped us separate us from the lies that we have been taught. We need leadership and we need guidance, because men, once they grow out of recovery, once men recognize that this essential energy that we have, or these essential energies that we have had in many ways have been abused and misused, we need a leader, we need guides into a creative and purposeful life. And one of the things that elders have done and mentors have done in the history of our world, and I would dare say that Jesus has done as a mentor, as a sage, and I'll talk more about that later, is to imagine a new human being. And I think the biblical record picks that up when Jesus becomes the new human one. And in fact, the men who follow him, or the community that follows him, becomes the new human. And those new humans act in decisive ways that make their mark on the world without marring the world. And then you recognize too that when anything new is created or is born into the world, something tries to destroy it. But Jesus lived with imminent death, the threat of imminent death, and those that followed with him began to live that same way. That when Jesus was born, that knew the divine child that we sing every Christmas, O come, let us adore him. We recognize that within the story, within the narrative, while others were attempting to adore him, be they wise men, or be they shepherds, or be they cattle, King Herod, in his abusive power, his abusive use of power, was getting ready to slay him. So whenever there's the new being born into the world, or imagining the world in a new way, there are forces that tend to destroy it. Well, Jesus was such a mentor. Jesus was such a sage. As a matter of fact, a friend of Holden, a man by the name of Marcus Borg, has written a whole book about Jesus and a new vision. That Jesus pointed not to himself, but to God. That God is the ultimate reality of human existence, and God as active in the real world. And this Jesus, whom we begin to know, represented God to the world in which he lived, and he represented God to males. Males who had been caught up in a patriarchal system that excluded others, that abused others. And we can look at the biblical narrative, almost any page of the biblical narrative, the New Testament points that out. So eldership and mentorship, as initiators, that's what I want to suggest that we might be, as initiators that take us and others from one place to another place. As initiatives, we become openness to learning. So one of the questions that has come to me is that, are men open? Are males open to the learning that Jesus and the narrative about him can give? And this movement from one space to another, it's liminal. A liminal change. You're on a threshold, going from one space to another. It's transformative. And I think that's the kind of energy, that's the kind of space that Jesus was moving men into, from one sense of reality to another. The elder or the mentor is able to point out the errors of a given way of life. The elder or the mentor is able to point to and to name the lies that govern our way of life. Jim was talking a little about this yesterday. He was using that mentorship, that eldership, that wise sageship when he was talking about his experience and his ministry in Phoenix in Arizona Lutheran Church, when he was talking about the various propagandistic techniques that mold us, that give us character, that lead us in various paths as men. And that the eldership, using this energy of understanding, new understanding, points out the errors of a given way of life, and it names publicly the lies that govern our way of life. And that's why the preaching office of the church has always been so important, because it names publicly the lies that govern our way of life, and it upsets the status quo. Or as a mentor of mine in Chicago said, that this particular energy, this energy of understanding, of wisdom, is a bullshit indicator. It can listen to something and say, that's a crock. It can see something and see, that's manipulation. The elder, the mentor, accessing this wisdom energy that each of us are born with, that's innate to us, is a practitioner of discernment. And it's on guard against the arrogance that we are up against as men. I think Luther began to delve into this sense of wisdom understanding in his distinctive differentiation between what he called the theology of glory and what he called the theology of the cross. The theology of the glory calls good evil, he said, and calls evil good. It's not honest. But what the theology of the cross does is to name something as it is, to tell the truth about it, to discern it, to call good good and to call evil evil. Discern and to guard against arrogance. There's one particular passage from Scripture that I always think about when I think about this particular energy functioning, and that's the encounter between King David and Nathan. And how David was the king in all his power, with a whole realm of the empire before him. And how at times he used that power extremely well, but how at times he abused that power. In this particular case with Bathsheba, he looked on her taking the bath and he wanted her. And he pursued that quest, almost that addiction, to have her. Even to the point of what? Arranging so that Uriah would be at the front of the line in battle so that he would be killed. An arrogant use of power. We all recognize that as the story goes. But no one dared point that out to David, that he had arrogantly misused his role as king, as orderer, as author of a community's life, until Nathan, that prophet, comes in and tells him that little story, which David didn't fully understand, until Nathan pointed out and said, the man is you. In a sense, what this Nathan did was begin to point out the arrogance and to take David down from the pedestal on which he had placed himself and said, you abuse your power. And I'm suggesting that that's part and parcel of what Jesus talks about when he talks about the men who follow him, moving them from one particular pattern of living to another. The elder then, or the mentor, bring oneself to greater maturity of life. We as Christians might want to call that our life in Christ with one another. And this energy, this energy to bring us to greater maturity is a part of all of us males, but it is seldom used. We do not give check and balance to what I call, and Marcus Borg calls, this conventional wisdom. Most of us, it seems to me, just accept what we are given and do the best we can. But this energy, what I'm suggesting, is a God-given innate within our genes, DNA, all that, helps us to come to greater maturity as we use it. We can get master's degrees in all sorts of fields, but seldom do men become past masters in personal growth, transformation, or identification with this Jesus who points us to God. The elder or the mentor, the kind of person I think we'd all like to be, the person that exposes the lies that our sons and our daughters live by, is the person who is able to know and to celebrate the resources of prayer, of worship, of sacred space, and to know that they are essential for growth and maturity, just as Holden, when it became a place set apart, set along aside a sacred space for worship, even though this whole area might be thought of a sacred space, there was a place into which was placed the altar. And to recognize, as Holden does, that prayer and worship and the singing of hymns and the sharing of stories, the preaching of the word, the sacred space as essential for growth and maturity. Well, this energy then, this energy of awareness, this energy of understanding, which I'm suggesting can show itself forth in the role of elder and mentor, in its fullness means that you and I might become keepers of awareness and insight. And how often do we find ourselves attracted to something that gave us awareness and insight? Or how many times has someone come up to us and wanted from us awareness or insight? But this awareness and insight, I suggest, is something that we learn to handle with caution. And as you read that narrative of Jesus and the men who followed him, how often that narrative speaks of handling this new awareness, this new insight, this new relationship with the one who represented God, to handle that relationship with caution. Because elders and mentors are aware of that which is not readily apparent or of common sense. That's why in Aboriginal tribes there was the medicine man, or in the history of our faith, the priest, or in other religions, the shaman, to which people went to find what was not readily apparent or of common sense. And so what elders and mentors do, and I suggest this particularly for young boys, is to use this energy, this wisdom, to monitor the data that people have to contend with by utilizing their wisdom. In for those of us who are Christian, that's the wisdom of God that we learn in this relationship with Jesus. It is an ego. It is a life that is invested in God, and not in earthly forms or human constructs. And isn't that part of the narrative that the men who followed Jesus had to learn? That their life was invested not in earthly forms. They were passing away. Jesus is constantly talking about the old order passing away and something new beginning. In other words, human constructs are not necessarily there for all time and all place. They change. And Jesus was constantly breaking that open. The parables tell us that. So what mentors and elders are able to do is to tap into that energy that knows that the earthly forms and the human constructs pass away and something new might be beginning. The elder and the mentor energy within each of us as men, remember, it's only one of four, enables us to do what? To think before we act, and to look before we leap. That's part of what Jesus was telling those disciples. Before you do something, think about it. Because if you live in this new reality, you best know how to act and to act rightly. But there's a downside, or so I believe, there's a downside to this energy. And for this I may need to draw something on the board. I think I've mentioned to you that I've come to understand these energies in the form of a pyramid. Each energy having its own pyramid, and when brought together. And this is one way that I currently am working to try to understand who Jesus is for me. That there are four pyramids. Each of them representing particular energy or particular power, particular gift, particular purpose, call it what you will, the power of nurture. All of us in our baptism are called to be nurturers. It's what the baptismal ritual, the importance of ritual, the importance of God speaking and we giving us, giving back promises. The power of nurture. The second one, which is a very dangerous one, they all have their dangers, but the power of aggression. The reason this is called aggression, or some people even call it warrior power, is that if we look at our history, even if you look at baptism in a particular way, human beings throughout history have been defined by war. It's the destruction that human beings have laid waste to fellow human beings. And part of baptism is to recognize this power that we have to obliterate and to annihilate as human beings, but to manage it in a proper way, in a way that's beneficial to life, that gives purpose to life, that is beneficial. Or as Don and I have talked, a life that is lived purposefully, a life that makes its mark on the world without marring the world. And that might be, as Don was saying, why Jesus is never to be thought of as a hero. Because a hero often makes his mark on the world, but in the process mars the world. But Shapiro is one, we were talking the other day about John Wayne, who obliterates the enemy violently and mars the human condition. But Jesus, in that particular use of that quadrant, calls us to live a life purposefully. Then the third is the one of wisdom and understanding. And that's why I began this afternoon's session with the way we think as men might be killing us. Because the realities that we think about are not necessarily the reality that God is. God is compassion. So says Jesus in Marcus 4. And can we find a way to tap into that wisdom, that compassionate power that is within us? And the last particular energy is the one of love or intimacy. Is that a particular power that men have to work with? Now, ideally, if you look at this as a pyramid, you're looking down on the top of it, right? A few of us have looked down on a pyramid. But if you look down on the top of it, all these various energies, all these various gifts, if you want to use Paul's language, they meet. And they meet in a constructive, a useful, and a purposeful way. And the religious life, or the meaningful life, is a life that in community moves us toward that capsule. What some psychologists have called the God self. But they're saying we move in that direction toward the God self, the imago Dei. We move with measured steps, and we move carefully, because most of us spend lives that are lived not at the capstone of the pyramid, but at its base. And notice that all of these, as the concept is drawn at least, need to touch one another, need to use one another. They cannot act independently, because if they act independently, what happens is that each of these energies become very imperialistic. In other words, they want us all. The warrior energy does not want to know anything about compassion, because that energy is out to make its mark on the world and doesn't want to have, in its full sense, too much time spent with that or with nurture. The illustration I use between King David and Nathan. King David was not nurturing his realm very well. He was being very, very arrogant in his use of kingly power. And yet he needed someone who was able to generate this sense of compassion and wisdom to point out this arrogance in David in order for David to repent and make amends. And you know as well as I do the tensions that existed in any human relationship between aggression and between love. How do men, males, work that out? That's part of the dilemma that you and I are in. And how do we approach this God self this understanding of God with us that is given to us in our baptisms. As I say, we approach in measured steps and we approach carefully, because people trying to be God, people trying to be all-powerful, can do what? They can become very narcissistic. All-powerful. Etc. And say, all people have to reflect me. I am the center of the universe. And yet the other, and I think is equally dangerous for men, is to abandon all sense of uniqueness, all sense of essentiality, all sense of purpose, all sense of partnership. Creatorship with God. What most depth psychologists will tell us is that what men need to do in this quest to become more authentic, and what elders and mentors teach, is not to identify with this God, but simply to relate to it. And it seems to me that's part and parcel of what Jesus was attempting to tell his disciples. Now, this essential energy of wisdom, as I've already said, has immense attraction and wisdom. Who would not like to be the person to whom everybody comes to answer all their questions? Whether it be our children, the littlest ones, grade school or teenagers, who would not like to have all that power? But what I'm wanting to suggest to us, and I hope we can talk about this in a few minutes, is that how might it show itself in bogus ways? And as Pastor Ines was saying yesterday, one of the ways that it shows itself is through propaganda. It's manipulative. Let's put that down here in terms of this particular pyramid. It's manipulative. Tries to mold people, pull people, form people into habits of the heart, if you will, that do not relate to any sense of who God is and what God is doing, but it's manipulative. It tries to conform, mold people into habits of heart. But as I say, mar in an attempt to mark the world. The press does that. At least many in the press are accusing of doing that. Spin doctors and political campaigns do that. Sometimes doctors or people in helping professions do that. They withhold information. The manipulator of this kind of wisdom withholds information that might be useful and beneficial to the people who need it. It's cruel. It's not power with, but it's power over. When I was campus pastor at the University of Chicago, so many times I would have PhD students come into my office talking about the cruelty of their PhD advisors, particularly the women. And how they would put unexpected or unreal demands on their students. And you talk to those PhD advisors, why do you do that? Well, that's how we were treated. So that's a manipulative or cruel use of that. It's detached, it's unrelated, and it's withholding. But the other aspect of that is what we could call the denial, denying one. Or the innocent one. That's the person who refuses to tap into their inner sense of wisdom.
I guess in the baptismal ceremony where it says you are given this cross of Christ, you know, it's sealed with the Holy Spirit for understanding forever, and God gives you wise counsel and understanding. The innocent one, the denying one, will say, oh, I can't tap into that. I'm not worthy of that. And what does that person do? He or she, or in our case for young boys, opens himself up to that manipulative power and becomes very masochistic in the process. I can do nothing. I don't have that power within me. And most of us can see with our own eyes, or I can see within mine, that we live at the base of this, on the base of this pyramid. We go back and forth. We brush up against people all days of our life that are either manipulative in their use of power, or they deny that have any access to this particular gift, power, in order to make a difference in the world. And so, when we come across young boys in gangs who have been fed lies, as we've been saying all week, the lie being children should be seen and not heard, what do? They form into bunches of cohorts and they exchange lies with one another about who they are as young boys, who their fathers are, who their mothers are, if they have parents, what women are for, what life is all about. And obviously in our society in America, those lies are within a society that's built on achievement and reward. And there are no elders in many of our communities because we live in a climate where eldership, when people reach a certain age, they move to retirement communities. Fortunately, we have here an elder hostel where people are beginning to talk about, again, at least the Association of Lutheran Older Adults is beginning to talk about the sense of mentoring and eldership and making themselves available in teams of twos and threes and what have you, to be elders to the children of their communities and their churches. The congregation that I serve in Chicago, before I came, they established a secret pal relationship with each child who was in primary school, had a secret pal relationship, and they penned notes back and forth, and it wasn't until Easter Sunday that they were introduced to their secret pal. But that formed a bond, a relationship between generations, between older folks or elders and the children of our parish. All right, I want to stop there and see if you have any response. Then I'd like us to talk about Jesus as a wise sage and as a regulator, if you will, of this God-self energy that we're introduced to, that we're incorporated into in our baptisms. So are there any response or hopefully disagreements or clarifications as to, you know, what I've been talking about for the last 45 minutes?
You always seem to be putting a mentor in a positive vein. Mm-hmm. There are many negative mentors. mentors out there who are not good role models for the youth and that sort of thing. And there, it seems like there's more of them coming online every day,
mm-hmm.
and more youths willing to follow their example.
I agree. And I think what I would say to that in response, not only in agreement, but those are the ones that fall into this bogus mentorship or shadow mentorship that is manipulative in the communities in which I live. You know, the drug pushers become the mentors, and they become very successful businessmen because there's a great deal of money in that. What I'm wanting us to talk about, and I'm glad for that recognition, is that how do we then, as men, develop within ourselves a sense of purpose and understanding that we find a way, and I'm not one to tell what that way is, definitively, of showing our boys the lies that they live by. One of the things that's disturbed me so much during the week I've been here, this last week, is there's one boy, and he was in Vespers last night, who's probably 11, who at the age of 11 has gone around every day said life sucks. And I don't know what to do. You know, I've thought of mentioning that in Vespers tonight, but I know he'll know who he is. And but at 11 years old, to come to an awareness, and there's anger in his voice and his face when he says that life sucks, is to me appalling. That 11 years old, that's already his operative way of living. That life sucks. Now, how do we as men, or how any, or comes from our church family, church community, how do we as men begin to talk to him? Or an older man here was talking about men don't talk about their daughters, to which the woman that he was talking to sat there with her mouth open. And again, I thought of tonight just collected a whole bunch of sayings that I've heard men say them tonight. But I think I've probably been a little bit too chicken to do that. But my concern is, how do men reclaim, in one book by a fellow named Goodman says, reclaim powers. How do men and women past the age of 45, 50, reclaim the powers of responsible adulthood and mentorship? And does the church, if you read between the lines of this one fellow's writings, does the church have any sense of eldering and mentoring people? When my son was baptized, the preacher, who's female German theologian, the first D'Arte Zola, in the first portion of the sermon said, "We baptize Aaron because we recognize that Bill and Karen cannot raise this child on their own. They are just not strong enough. And so we baptize Aaron into a community of support, because this community recognizes that we live within a world that overwhelms us. And that's why, at least in Chicago where I live, the churches in these communities surrounding Hyde Park, the University of Chicago where I live, the men of those communities have gone back to church. It's great. Because in the black church, very few men have attended. But in those communities, men are aggressively pursuing church, aggressively pursuing Bible study, aggressively pursuing, if you will, discipleship, so they can get in touch with their children and pull them away from this manipulative power, this sadistic, masochistic power that has entrapped their kids. And what I'm suggesting is that we in the church might see them as examples of what we might do.
One comment you come in ahead of where I'm at, but about being mentors to, for instance, our children, especially boys, and those around us. And you mentioned, you know, there's so many negative examples. One thing I think has helped me grow somewhat in this and is still much ahead is, you know, there's that passage in 1 Peter 1, around verse 18. You have been ransomed, you have been redeemed, you have been rescued from the vain conversation or mode of life learned from your fathers. And I kind of made use of that, like, I had several interns, I said, you know, in our conversations together, you have to have every week touch base. How things. I said, you're going to learn and feel some good things doing ministry with me. You're going to probably see some things that you're going to say, that I would not do it that way. And I said, that's fine. So you can learn from the positive thing, but you can also learn from the negative things. Mm-hmm. And I've been more and more sharing that with my children. Whatever good you've seen in me, because I'm getting old, you know, go for it. But whatever is not good and not according to Jesus, flee from that point. And I think, you know, that's kind of where I'm at. Mm-hmm. That makes sense?
Makes sense to me, Don. And I think, you know, you're using that line from 1 Peter. I think one of the scary things about this, and at least I find it, and I often disclose more than I probably ought to, at least in retrospect as I, you know, go back, is that he talked about the vain learnings, the vain teachings that you got from your fathers. I think that one of the clear threads that runs through the various movements of so-called men's movement, those movements, is that men coming to some sort of understanding of who their fathers were and what we are because of that. Is that most of us have lived, if our fathers were living at all, I was adopted, so I have an adopted father, were distanced from us because most of us lived with fathers who were ingrained to be emotionally distant from their sons. Now, I mean, you give me illustrations that that wasn't necessarily the case with you and your dad. But, you know, what is it in that particular verse from 1 Peter that tells us that we as men have some work to do with our fathers? We're going to be talking about that tonight in Vespers. And what is that work that needs to be done? And how dangerous might that work be for men to deal with some of the memories of their dads, both the good and the not so good. Because I think that pulls me into at least a better or more productive understanding of looking at the men who followed Jesus, is that they were pulled away from the teachings of their fathers, that they were pulled away from the teachings of patriarchy, and that they were pulled away from the men who attempted to perpetuate some of those teachings. That Jesus pulled men, those disciples, those cohorts, as I've begun to call it, away from those who wanted to use this energy that's on the right in a zealous way. That's when I was in high school, this book of Jesus and the Passover plot, it's called, and got me interested in the historical Jesus, and that how Jesus identified, but did not, I should say, he related to, he did not identify with the zealots of that time, those men who wanted to use violence to, quote, bring in the kingdom of God. So what is it that we as men then have to learn anew, even if we be 52, such as myself, or you, Don, who are 1 or 2 years older than I am?
65.
Okay, 65. But it seems that you've worked on that. You've worked on your authenticity, your authorship. How do we allow our lives to be authored by God? And can we, as men, find a way to speak about that? Most men I know don't want to talk about that at all. I don't know about your experience.
One caution, maybe, just a minor thing, but you mentioned several times, Papa Zebedee, and they broke with that.
Yeah.
Went in a new direction. Maybe also, though they were redeemed from some of the vain ways learned from their father, he was a businessman. They even had servants.
Yep.
I have found very few dads can run a business and have all their sons in it. And those that do, I know one of them, 3 out of his 4 sons are with another one, very successful, has 3 sons. And I try to analyze, how does this happen? But anyway, that's another. But again, what I'm trying to say is maybe Papa Zebedee had something good going that could help make Peter a leader. He knew how to manage that fishing business. And sure, I don't want to undercut what you're saying. Yeah. They were going in a radically new way, but still, some of that probably went off. Another thing I've thought of, and you've heard this before, when Jesus called these disciples, sure, they were common, but they weren't bummers. Well, those other two, and Peter and Andrew, James and John, they were in the fishing business. Like, even that other one in that main tax office, he was a go-getter.
I agree. And what I'm saying is, as we look at this whole relationship with the men, the males that followed Jesus, and the transformation that occurred into their lives. Now, that's using the narrative of the Gospels in a somewhat creative way. Obviously, that's reading between the lines and playing with the text, but I think we're free to do so. And part of my thinking is that, they leave Zebedee in the boat. What was Zebedee thinking about? I need these guys, from his point of view, it was a loss. From their point of view, they're going in a different direction. How did Zebedee begin to think? And then, of course, at the end of the narrative, toward the end of the narrative, it's these same two that still haven't got it. They want the power and the glory when Jesus gets to his power and glory. The same two that left their father in the boat.
But isn't it nice to have that little note in there? With the hired servant. They didn't
That's
leave
right.
him high and dry.
That's right, with the hired servant.
One thing that was occurring to me when you were talking here, Bill, is that it seems like that we have such a large society now, and our images get developed sometimes way away from where we are, And they come in maybe through the TV or they come through all the advertising and it goes on. And another part of our society, being large, is that we still live in a very compartmentalized society. And so we have, it seems to me, and I was thinking about this, I was watching this movie Shogun when we were out, and that societies have done that now for so long. For example, in Japan, they even had a warrior class for people where people bred over generation after generation, that a certain group of people would be the warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And this has happened in other societies too. And so I wonder what that does to us being able to balance all these energies in ourselves when we say, well, these are the people then that are going to be the warriors. And these people over here will be the priests and the pastors, and they'll have understanding or love. And these people over here will be the women. Maybe they'll nurture the society.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what happens when our society gets so overly compartmentalized? And I think, one thing that I see hopeful is that I think there's some sense in which we're trying to move out of that, at least if some people are conscious of that, maybe we need to learn in a more balanced way, that we don't just learn one thing in life, and that we don't just leave having more up to the generals.
Mm-hmm.
Or we don't, you know, that I think we've tried to get away with that, with at least giving nodding to the idea of democracy, but I don't think we really have embraced that idea. I think we still embrace the old European idea that you go do your job and nobody else ever gets to talk to you about it.
No, I like your comment where we don't just leave war up to the generals or up to the Pentagon or the Department of Defense. You know, that because if it's left to them alone, they're going to manage in a way that's certainly not very, you know, promising for me. And, you know, just internally or psychologically, is that when we become so aggressive, so clear-sighted to pursue this particular goal, that we do so at the expense of all these other energies that manifest themselves within our lives. And that sometimes we need to develop a check and balance of that, because that particular energy left by itself can be what all the critics of our American democracy have said, is that it becomes very imperialistic. And it becomes very invasive. And, you know, what I'm looking for is a society that can steward various aspects of, you know, the given self in a way that is not invasive. How do we create, how do we defend, and how do we extend our values in ways that are not invasive?
That's a real good point you made about delegating these different areas to certain segments. But, you know, as I hear you two fellows talk, I almost want to ask you, well, the whole pacifist, you know, I mean, honest, bona fide pacifist, well, you don't have to answer that, but I see, for instance, in the Gospels, in Acts, this one fellow that comes, he's a centurion, army officer, and he's devout. He built the synagogue for them. Even there, well-trained, competent, God has entered in. Or you think, you know, Cornelius down there at the headquarters, Caesarea Maritima, God's working in him. He has a devout household. And, you know, then Paul over there in Rome, penetrating even the Caesar's choice guard and making converts. I understand the first martyrs in the Christian church were those nine Christian soldiers that marched out of a frozen lake and died there. You know, there were some, not the first martyr, but one of the earliest sets of martyrs. Y'all see
Yeah, well, that wasn't what I was talking about. I was saying that that we shouldn't leave war just up to the warriors. In other words,
you're saying, class.
Yeah, we shouldn't leave aggression, and we don't, and because we see in the streets all the aggression that young boys have, and all that, and so we should acknowledge that that's there.